Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Jeremy Larder, a producer, writer, and director whose credits include two seasons of the comedy series Just Passin' Through and the feature film Poggy Beach, which is now available for rental and purchase on iTunes. Just Passin' Through is a show about two guys from Prince Edward Island who turn up on a Toronto cousin's doorstep, which lines up nicely with Jeremy's pick for the podcast, Going Down the Road, Don Shabib's 1970 drama starring Douglas McGrath and Paul Bradley as two guys from the Maritimes who head off to Toronto in search of fortune and glory, or at least decent jobs and solid relationships, only to be ground down by the big pitiless city. It's a footnote in world cinema, but a landmark in English Canada, so well regarded here that even an awful, awful sequel made 40 years after the fact couldn't dent its reputation. It's an important film. You know, if you're from Toronto. This is someone else's movie.
I mean, it's still my favorite Canadian film, and I saw it when I was in my early to mid-20s, I think, for the first time, and I had just moved to Toronto from PEI.
Okay.
So I was very much relating to Pete and Joey at that moment, being an East Coaster in the big city.
How had you not seen it before then? I would think that it's like, it's almost a cliche at this point that anybody out East is going to experience Toronto through that film. Where I suppose they were in the 70s and 80s when it was, you know, constantly being brought up in cultural conversation as one of the great defining Canadian films. And I do think it is, but it's sort of fallen away recently.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Is that why you just didn't, was it around to be?
I don't know. I'm 39 now, so I was late teenager, early 20s, like around the 2000, like early 2000. So I just don't think it was available. It wasn't like readily available then. Like it was kind of hard to find. Like I don't think it was a movie that I could have found in my local video store.
Yeah. There was I remember this. There was a DVD release with a really good commentary track by Jeff Pevere.
Yes.
But I don't remember when that happened. It must have been like 2003, 2004.
That's the one I found.
Yeah.
And then when I went to Sheridan, Jeff was actually a teacher there. So we got to take a few GO train trips from downtown Toronto to Sheridan and talk movies, which was like a big thrill for me because I used to watch him when he was doing, I think he might have been like a reviewer for CTV back then or something, as well as like his another gig. He was just like very patient. I mean, I was just like a 24, 25-year-old film student, like, you know, picking his brain and chatting. So, but he was really good about talking about anything. So
yeah. So did Going Down the Road come up?
Yeah, I think it did. I remember we talked about Hal Ashby movies a lot, and it was around that time, I think it may have been just before my year at Sheridan, that I discovered the DVD of Going Down the Road with his commentary. And yeah, I think that must have been a movie that came up, because it was very prominent in my mind at that time.
Yeah, so as someone who's come from the East to Toronto, what was your experience of the film? How did you find it?
Well, I mean, I was just struck by how authentically Maritimes it was, because I think that's like a very hard thing to do for, I mean, Shabib, I think he said he had relatives, like uncles or aunt, like an uncle or something, who basically lived that story more or less of Going Down the Road. But I was struck by how authentic it felt to me. Like, it just seems like it's a thing, it's very difficult for actors like to put on East Coast accents and but yeah, I was just, and I also had friends of my family my dad's age, who had gone to Toronto in the 70s. So they had stories about going to Toronto.
Yeah.
And it just felt very real to me. Like, it just felt like a very authentic story of two East Coasters.
Yeah. It's one of those films that has never felt fully real to me, and I'm not totally sure why. The documentary style is amazing, but I was a kid in Toronto in the 70s, and when they go down to, you know, Yonge Street, to the misery walks that they take because they're lonely and aimless. When I was 12 or 13 and doing that for the first time on my own, it was like the greatest experience. I had a completely different reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching it again as I got older and realizing, oh no, of course, you idiot, you had no understanding of anything that these guys were going through, or let alone the rural to urban migration story that is apparently what Shabib wanted to tell before. Like, according to a couple of Canadian encyclopedia sources, it was originally developed as a documentary project, which makes no sense to me. Shabib was thinking about shooting it
and just following some people, and then decided that it would work better as a narrative, and somehow that transmogrified into the documentary style verite story that he did shoot. That's never made sense to me. And the documentary would have been completely different, I would think, just because you're dealing with a story that makes, you know, like, it doesn't make sense as non-narrative. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. It's I'm trying to understand this film that makes no sense to me that it exists the way it did.
In what way does it not make sense to you?
Well, it's the birth of English Canadian cinema, and it's the story of an incredibly mundane, depressing reality that somehow feels alive and immediate and instant. And all I can think of is, if you did this as a documentary, it would have just been mundane. It would have been, you know, Frederick Wiseman kind of level of flat despair, which is not a negative thing. It's just that the movie that it is so alive and electric and weird. It's a movie that is inventing a kind of cinema because it doesn't know it shouldn't be doing it. I guess that's it. Like, the idea that the story it tells is so miserable and downbeat. It's a story about two guys who have their entire youth and energy and vitality and optimism chewed up and spat out by the smallest, worst decisions people can make. And being each other's worst enabler, and, you know, just, like, people leave their wives all the time. Like, it's just, it's horrible, except that it's so alive that you sort of understand how they're talking each other into this stuff, because it's just, like, they're drunk all the time, and it's a kind of a good time feeling that they're desperately exuding. It's, like, it should be so depressing, and somehow, every time I watch it, it's weirdly upbeat and perky, even though it ends very, very badly.
Yeah, it does, and the thing I noticed when I watched it again recently was that how much of it's Pete. Pete is the one that's, like, pulling Joey along. Joey doesn't really... He's kind of just, like, a very passive passenger on the train. He's not really doing a whole lot. He's kind of going with the flow. And I was just... Because I never noticed that before, how much it's Pete's... It's really Pete's story. And, like, he's... At one point, like, Joey... He'd be perfectly happy, like, settling down with Jane Eastwood's character and having a life.
There's a kid on the way.
He's got a kid on the way, and he's totally happy to settle there. But it's really Pete who's driving them to, like, keep looking for that dream and keep, you know, to keep going west. It's not working in Toronto, let's just leave.
Yeah, just the sense that if you keep moving, nothing can catch you. But the desolation that they're leaving in their wake, I mean, they're just... Everyone they meet is going to be diminished by knowing them. I guess that's what's so weird about it. If you look backwards, it's, oh yeah, this guy destroys this woman's life, beats this other guy up in a parking lot. Like, everything they do, with the best of intentions, goes so badly, so quickly, and yet the film just chugs right along with them. Like, the movie knows, but it's trying its best to keep up with them, and so we sort of get suckered into it as well. Yeah, no, Pete's not a good person.
No.
But he is so enthusiastic and chummy. I gotta say, the last time I watched this, I started thinking about Fight Club, which makes no sense, but kind of does, right? Like, it's that weird toxic enthusiasm, your friend who just constantly makes the wrong decisions, but you love him, so you keep going along with him. And then after a while, you convince yourself that maybe they're not the wrong decisions.
That's just interesting.
See how it plays out.
Today, like, when I just watched it, I was thinking about Mean Streets a lot for some reason.
Okay, yeah.
It was reminding me of, like, the Charlie...
and Johnny Boy.
Johnny Boy relationship. I had never thought of that either before. How much... Yeah, it's these two friends who are kind of, like, helping each other make terrible choices and going down this bad path together. And there's, like, no way to stop it, basically.
Yeah, and maybe that's the difference between American and Canadian cinema at that time, too, because the Ebert review of Going Down the Road, which was way more enthusiastic than I remembered. I went back and reread it, and he loved it. He actually held it up as the anti-husbands. He said that the rawness and the reality, I'm horribly paraphrasing, the rawness and reality of the performances in Going Down the Road puts the lie to Cassavetes' movie about a bunch of actors narcissistically killing time in front of a camera. And this is the movie that Cassavetes would have made the Cassavetes of Shadows would have made. And watching it now, it feels like the difference is that the Canadian film is non-judgmental, and the Americans need a moral ending. They always need to have punishment or comeuppance or misery. Going Down the Road is like, it ends with us knowing what they don't, which is that this is, you're going to regret this, that this isn't going to go well.
Mm-hmm.
The next trip isn't going to go well. The next destination is going to be just as bad. Like, Edmonton's not going to do any better.
No.
Assuming
that. And there's no Yonge Street in Edmonton. Yeah. Either. Like, what are you going to do with no Yonge Street?
It's just, yeah, that sense that if we keep going, we'll find the best dream, we'll find the best place. There's a specific kind of naivete, but it's also about the myth-making of Canada, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Toronto was the place, Toronto's still the place to be, unless you go to Vancouver, and that's what happens in the sequel. And have you seen the sequel?
I haven't watched the sequel. I was intrigued by it, but I didn't want to. I just, because the film has a kind of a special place in my heart, and I just didn't really. I'm happy knowing that those two guys went on the road and they just went west, and I don't need to know anymore.
Yeah, that's fair. The sequel is, I mean, it picks up in Vancouver, and it's, or near Vancouver, and it just, yeah, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't exist. It's one of those things that just doesn't need to be, especially since one of the actors had died by the time it mm-hmm. started, and it was just all about reckoning with that space that his absence leaves, and a film about Pete reckoning with the loss in his life is not nearly as interesting, I suspect, as a film about Joey reckoning with it. That would have been,
yeah,
that would have been the story worth telling.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you haven't seen it, there's really no point going further. And if people are listening, please don't bother. Just stick with the original.
But I'm glad that Don Shabit kind of, like, he found his love for his own movie again, because I remember when he came to our class at Sheridan.
Oh, yeah.
In 2005. And everyone was very excited to have him come in. Everyone wanted to talk about was Going Down the Road. And then he came in and he didn't even have it on his reel. Like, he showed us a reel of his work and he didn't have going Down the Road on it. And everyone was kind of stunned and he didn't want to talk about it. And he seemed to have like a kind of like a grudge against it. And we were a bit shocked by that. And it seems like it somehow, somewhere after that, he found an appreciation for this movie again. So I was happy that he was at least kind of reckoning with this work that he had made.
Yeah, that really surprises me. I mean, well, I guess I can sort of see it. You know, if you make this one thing that refuses to go away and everything else you do isn't that thing. He did other film, he did other work that is very, very good. It's just not the same thing. And yeah, if he'd left and come back, maybe it would have been easier. But in Canada, we're not really too crazy about people who succeed. We haven't yet figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
If you succeed on your own terms and continue doing interesting work, apparently that's less interesting than if you succeed here, go to America, and then come home. And we're, like, the culture is more easily accessible that way. People are more willing to celebrate you if you've left and come back, which never made any sense to me. But that is, of course, what Going Down the Road is almost about.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, it's such a strange... It's an underdog movie about people who have they're brave enough to risk everything and try. And then as soon as it's difficult, as soon as, like, the second things don't go their way. Yeah, I'm really wrestling with it. I'm even just describing it sounds like an incredibly banal experience. These two guys come to this town, they kind of start relationships, one of them falls in love, buys some stuff on credit, and then loses his job at the bottling plant. Like, it sounds like self-parody now.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1970, that was revelatory for a lot of people. We hadn't seen, you know, Canada is still such a big country that we don't really interact except through our culture with other parts of it. So a movie about two Maritimers coming to Toronto would be seen here and would be embraced here, possibly, because it was Canadian and because it told the story and because it was this ugly reality. And now it's this weird historical document of how we saw each other.
Mm-hmm.
And how the most conventional narrative is the thing you need to tell that story. Like, you have to plug it into something recognizable so they're not caricatures.
Yeah.
And then you get performances, you get the life of it.
Well, the performances in the movie are what still, I think, are the major standouts. Like, I mean, I can't remember the actor's name who plays Joey, but, like, he is obviously such a wild card. I mean, you can just see it. Like, it just, like, comes out of him that he's a complete, you know, loose cannon to a certain extent. And how they corralled him into, like, giving that performance, I don't know how, like, what Shabib had to do to kind of wrangle him. I'm pretty sure the actor who played Pete was a professional, but I don't know the story about Joey.
Don McGrath,
yeah.
We can look it up. We can take a second because I'm suddenly realizing I don't recognize that name. It's not coming to my mind either.
Paul Bradley. Because he did a few films after that, but I don't think he was a trained actor.
I'm just going to look it right up here. Yeah, he worked. He made a few movies. A film called Stone Cold Dead, a film called Cross Country, Blindside. He worked throughout the set. Well, not throughout, but he worked regularly through the 70s and 80s.
Was he born... Did you say if he was born on the East Coast? It
just says born in Canada. Died in Victoria in 2003. Yeah.
But he definitely comes across as authentically East Coast. To me, at least, anyway. But he's just full of such life. I mean, and there's so many wonderful scenes. And, like, everyone who's in the background, all the extras, and, like, the other guys in the bottling plant are kind of, like, part of their little crew. Like, they just feel so real. Like, it just has, like, an air of authenticity to it that still, to me, is kind of remarkable.
Yeah. Well, it's that... Like, that's the thing that makes me believe that it was... conceived as a documentary project, just the sense of verite and the sense that they were looking for people being themselves who were just existing in the moment. The scene in Allen Gardens, where you just suddenly see, oh yeah, Toronto does kind of have this weird, lively arts culture. And the idea that in 1970 that they would go to Yonge Street instead of Yorkville, which was where like all the countercultural revolutionary stuff was happening, that makes perfect sense because they wouldn't have known about Yorkville, or they would have dismissed it as being too... you know, too weird and flower childy.
There's the great scene in the Sam the Record Man store too, is kind of like a beautiful lyrical scene. Like the music in that scene is so, and there's like the interaction between Pete and that woman, and just the glances back and forth. It's full of musical montages, like, and that's another thing that I kind of forgot about how it's got like five or six great musical montages strung throughout that tell so much of the story of the two guys.
Yeah, and it's stuff that was clearly found in the moment, right? Like the montages are so different from the way the regular conventional dialogue stuff unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered this time through, you know, like, did they pick it up? Did they figure it out? Did they go back and patch it together? And is this how you cover a scene that you didn't quite get, or is this always the plan? Was it supposed to contrast with these, you know, these longers almost of dialogue-less encounter, the sense of the city? Is that what we're getting? It's this weird puzzle because it feels like it's not playing by the rules. And then you realize that, yeah, it's literally figuring it out. I've already said this. I'm sorry. I'm repeating myself.
No, it's funny because it is very much in the verite documentary style, and it's shot that way, but the scenes are actually covered fairly conventionally. Like, it's like a lot of the movie is shot like a very conventional film, but yet it still has that documentary feel throughout. And even the way, like, there's a scene of the guys on the first night when they're in Toronto and they have to go to the Salvation Army. And they're sitting in those little bunks. And there's the shots of the other men. It looks like they actually walked into the Salvation Army and, like, filmed actual people that were there.
I would assume, yeah.
And just stuck the two actors in with them. And the camera's kind of back, and they're on the long lens, and they're just watching them, and the two actors just fit in with all these other faces that are in that space.
Yeah.
It does feel like you're watching a documentary.
Yeah, you get the sense that the city is alive around them.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just sets and you know, background management, that people are being steered through a scene. You know, it's that whole thing where every TV show now with a walk and talk will have one actor, one day player walk past the camera first to let you know the real story is about to start, that weird cue. There's none of that. There's no sense that this stuff was thought out or planned elaborately. It's just, boom, here we are in the moment. It's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Sam the Record Man and the Salvation Army, these are all, they're locations that would have been hard to manage in 1970 just because there's so much stuff going on in the city.
But it feels like they just walked in Sam the Record Man and shot the scene. Like, it seems like they just walked upstairs with the camera and maybe some sound equipment and just shot the scene in the upstairs of Sam the Record Man and walked out. That's what it feels like. I don't know that's what they did, but
I wouldn't be surprised. That's the other thing too, now that you mention it, that I'm realizing it's the lighting that looks natural and real, because it is. There is no kit, there's no crew. For most of the stuff, you're just seeing people in rooms and people in stores with available light. And it does change your relationship to the story. Like, somehow in your brain, you just think, oh, this is real. This is actually happening.
Yeah. And actually, Richard Leiderman, who was the DP, was an instructor at Sheridan. So he was there. I think his last year at Sheridan was the year that I was there.
Oh, yeah.
So it was amazing to have him around. He was a great guy, just as a side note. But, yeah, it just has that... But it is funny because, like, then it also has this very conventional sort of not a Hollywood narrative, but it does have that kind of like classic rise and fall story
structure
that's strung throughout it.
Although their rise is really just color TV.
Their rise is a couple of fun nights on Young Street, and well, then there's like the scene at the Maritimer's Bar, which is another fantastic scene where they like. It looks like they just like walked into a bar in Toronto and there happened to be a performer up there. I can imagine they didn't get permits or clearances for anything or anyone.
Yeah.
And
no, you didn't have to do that then. Like, no one knew you needed those things.
Yeah. So they're just, I think they just, you know, there's like this guy singing a song about Nova Scotia and they're, Paul Bradley looks like he's had a few in the scene. And I don't know. It's just, the film is full of those wonderful scenes. So it's like, when you say it's not playing by the rules, like there is something to that where it has those great improv, real life, just in the moment scenes mixed in with these scripted dialogue scenes. They sort of manage to kind of fit in, and you can't really see the cracks or the seams that much.
Yeah, well, it has such a strange energy that anything can happen, right? Like it's possible for all of this stuff to be happening while we're watching it because it's. The film is open to that. Maybe that's why the structure works so well, because part of your expectations are that they're going to go and have an adventure and then we will learn something. Like that's what narrative is. But the things that happen are strange and unpredictable in a way that a road trip movie would be, except they don't really keep driving.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a road trip movie where you stay still, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
We see where they came from. We see where they are. And then in the end, they're moving again. And even the title just sort of explains that that's what's going to be happening, that this is a film about leaving or going forward, but then you, in the end you realize that they're going forward because they can't look back.
They can't look back, even though that's an element of it. Well, that's what makes the Pete character so different than your average Maritimer, I would say. Most Maritimers always want to go back.
Mm-hmm. So is that just a nativist impulse? Like things are better at home, or is it...
Well, I don't know. We're just very... I mean, it's a generalization. I think that just the Maritimers, like, if... I know a lot of people who came to Toronto and various places, you know, and they're looking for different things in their lives. And if it doesn't work out after a few months, like, the impulse is to always go back home. We're just very tied to home. Like, it's just kind of like if something doesn't work or, if, you know, and a lot of people my age now are moving back home.
Mm-hmm.
And Joey in the film has that instinct to go back.
Yeah.
A couple of times he's ready to go back.
And he's not wrong.
He'll
probably be better off.
Well, in the end, when they have to make their quick escape from the city, like they would be so much better off if they just go back east than keep going west. You know, you just know that that's not going to work out very well.
Yeah, and that's the other underlying thing, right? The idea that the thing they're most afraid of is not making it. So if you go home, if you go home to safety, you're also admitting that you couldn't hack it out west. And so they'll just keep going west until they find a place where they can. And we know that's not going to work. The audience by that point, 90 minutes in, is just like, no, buddy, you're not going to make it. This is not how you behave in the world. And I could never figure out if it's an indictment of naivete or optimism, if Shabib is saying something about small towns, because Toronto is still a pretty small town, all things considered, in 1970, but it's too big for them, because as soon as, you know, they fall in love with the comforts, they fall in love with, and they're not that comfortable. It's a little house, or there's a little apartment.
Yeah, they're both stuck in that one apartment together.
Yeah,
and then
their ambitions are very modest, and the city still kills them. Like, the city still destroys their hopes. And it's not anything that they do or don't do. I mean, there are wrong choices. But, like, they come out honestly. They're here to work. They're here to find relationships. They're here to make themselves happy. And nobody cuts corners. And they're working at a bottling plant. And it's all, like, it's all perfectly legitimate. And still, their optimism won't save them. Because
no.
It's the first challenge that they all fold. Like, well, they don't fold, but Pete folds.
Yeah.
And pulls Joey along with him.
Pulls Joey along with him. And Pete brings Joey to, basically convinces Joey to come. Isn't it, these are other little details that I kind of forgot about until I rewatched it, but it's Pete that convinces Joey to come to Toronto and then promises him that they have a place to stay and promises Joey that they have a job waiting for them when they get there, and that turns out to be bogus. As soon as they get there, they find out that neither of those things are true. They don't have jobs and they don't have a place to stay. So immediately, you know that things are not going to work out for these two lads very well.
Yeah. I think, I'm pretty sure I must have seen the SCTV parody of it first.
Oh, yeah.
Was that your experience as well?
I'm not sure if I saw the parody first, but I remember... Actually, it was funny because it was when Shabib came to my class to chair, and that Shabib said that he thought the SCTV sketch was better than Going Down the Road. And then I think it was after that that I saw the SCTV sketch.
Okay, I mean it does have better timing. I mean I will give them that. It's the cutting and the timing of it is amazing. It's because you can only, you know, you're doing it in 7 minutes, so you can't go wrong. You're basically getting the greatest hits of the film.
Oh yeah, and then
through the lens of parody.
And whenever it would, you know, if they get stuck anywhere, it's just Yonge Street, and then they go cut straight to Yonge Street.
Yeah,
and everything's solved.
And it's a weirdly good-natured version of the actual events of the film. Like the SCTV parody is somehow more open-hearted than the film itself, which was the thing that confused me when I saw the movie. I finally realized, yeah, this is mean. This is like, it's a story about optimism being rewarded with failure, but it's also, there's a domestic drama in here that's absolutely shattering, and I think that's the thing I've been trying to talk around this whole time. The idea of, like, if you saw the whole movie from Jane Eastwood's point of view, which they kind of come close to in the sequel, it's a horror story. It's the story of this nice woman who picks the wrong guy.
Yeah.
And gets left behind. And none of that is in the SCTV version, which I know I must have seen beforehand because I was obsessively watching all that. So to come to the movie, I think that's why I keep seeing it as harder and meaner than it really is, just because that nice lady, you know, it's awful to watch that happen.
In retrospect. I'm a parent now too, so that element of it really resonates with me more, like the how awful it is that they just pick up and go and leave her in that situation. It is pretty horrific and kind of unforgivable, an unforgivable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not Joey, it's Pete. It's Pete that's like basically pulling Joey along and convincing him to like just leave town and leave his wife and unborn child.
Yeah. He doesn't even offer the "we'll come back"
thing,
the thing that you would think would be the one thing that would make it okay. It's just like, nah, let's go. We'll just go. And maybe, not maybe. I mean, it definitely feels to me like a solidarity thing. Like, they're not our people. She's not one of us. We can just go. But you can see it in Joey. He doesn't feel that way. And there's this moment of sort of elasticity where if he snapped back, he wouldn't necessarily be the happiest person in the world, but he could have found a way. He could have made a life. He could have been, there's a way to make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the fact that the movie just doesn't give us that is so, there's that. And there's Nobody Wave Goodbye as just Canadian films that are absolutely unsentimental about the awful things people do to each other, out of self-justification. And I don't know which one lands harder, but they're both surprisingly mean-spirited about that. And it's not even mean-spirited, it's just honest, right? People make bad decisions in the world all the time. And that's it. You're denied the happy ending or any even semblance of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of impressed that the sequel is all about regret, even though it doesn't seem to know it is. The movie doesn't work at all. The sequel.
Yeah, I think I read your review of it. Yeah, you weren't a big fan of it. I
hated it. And it's just, it's one of those things, and I really don't want to spend the whole podcast talking about it, but I'm still mad at it. It's one of those films where it doesn't betray the original. It's a reasonable continuation, but at the same time, you understand that it's the least interesting version of that story. And, you know, it's the wrong perspective. It's, McGrath is weirdly passive, and not in a way that Pete would be. He's just gone off and ended up in Vancouver and he's happy. He works as a mail carrier and everything's fine. And then he gets Pete's ashes and is asked to drive them back, and that's the movie, basically. And it's just not compelling or interesting, and there's no reckoning with his own past, because he's not the kind of guy who does that. And that's sort of the problem. Like, again, if it was Joey, it would be a more interesting film. But the reason it's so disappointing is that the original is so rich, I think, and there is so much going on in Shabib's film, economically and emotionally and socially. Like, it's this fascinating piece of a city that I lived in and I was here for, and I was two. I mean, it's not my fault. But there are strata in the city that are revealed in that movie that are fascinating to me, because I never encountered them, because they were just gone by the time I was old enough to go down to Yonge Street, and that now Toronto is so completely different as to be unrecognizable almost 50 years later.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, like, I think East Coasters, like, Yonge Street, going to Yonge Street is still, like, a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's because of going down the road, but, or the SCTV sketches, or what, but...
Probably some combination of the
two. And Toronto always has, like, a weird... There's always, like, a weird... Not hatred, that'd be too strong, but there's a lot of disdain for Toronto.
Oh, yeah. Back east. Oh, no, the rest of the country hates us. We know that.
But I feel like that's easing off a bit. Am I wrong with that? Like, do I feel like the whole hating Toronto thing is kind of, like, cooled off?
I hope so.
Slightly?
I don't know. Like, I've lived here my whole life, and I'm well aware that, just in terms of culturally, we are the great Satan of Canada. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because, you know, we present ourselves as the economic and political capital, even though that's, I mean, it's probably true, but it's also not true, because Ottawa is literally the capital. So I think if you spend all of your time outside of Ontario watching Toronto take credit for everything that Canada does, yeah, you could probably get tired of that really fast. Mm-hmm. But now between Toronto and Vancouver, I think we're equally hated in terms of real estate and livability and all that stuff.
And everything else. So how do you feel, like, where's Going Down the Road place in terms of, like, great Toronto movies or good Toronto movies?
I think it's an essential one in terms of showing us a Toronto that isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that a lot of Cronenberg's early films are. Videodrome, for example, it's like his last early film. It's before the midpoint started. That's practically a document of city TV in the early 80s. And the world that it shows is amazing to me, because I walk those streets and I remember those locations, but they're all gone now. You can't find them. Going Down the Road is the same, although it's even more further back.
And there's a scene when they first come into the city too. I was trying to figure out where that was. Like, there's one shot where they're shooting from behind the car.
Driving in on the Gardener, definitely.
Driving on the Gardener, but then there's one shot in particular where they're kind of, like, coming into the city for the first time. Like, there's, like, the shots on the Gardener, and then there's, like, a shot from behind them, and it looks like, but I can't place the street anywhere. It's, like, kind of a residential, like, it could be Bloor, maybe, somewhere. Like, it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah, nothing was developed then. So it is entirely possible when you drove off the ramp, you would just see houses.
Yeah.
There's a section of the Don Valley Parkway that leads out into, it exits onto the Danforth, basically, and that's, you turn around, you go up a hill, and there's houses, but the shape is wrong. It's not, it can't be that. I'm sure Torontoists must have done a Going Down the Road location breakdown.
Yeah.
They do remarkable ones for anything shot here.
It's, yeah, there. There's like a very, yeah, and like a very detailed one, but Degrassi, like the original, yeah. Degrassi, I've seen that one. And then there's a scene on Toronto Island too, where, like, the skyline is just, like, it's just completely different.
Yeah, there's like three buildings.
But people are still lounging around Toronto Island the same way.
Yeah, that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed that much.
That's one of those things that comes back every now and then. There's Daniel Kahn made a movie called An Eye for Beauty that has a lengthy scene. The end of the first act is set on the Toronto Islands in a house, and it feels like you're peeking into some fantasy world that doesn't exist, because it's one of the characters, I think she's a paralegal or a lawyer. Takes the protagonist home with her, and she lives on the island, and so they ride bikes through the city to get to the ferry, and then they take the ferry over, and then you see the little community, and you just keep thinking, this is like a Wicker Man movie. This is some secret society just off Toronto. What's going to happen? And nothing happens. They just have sex, and in the morning they leave. It's so strange to see that little digression into a part of the city that just nobody thinks about. except the people who live there. And yeah, going down the road has the same effect on me because I'm seeing a world that's just gone now. I was never privy to it. It's like watching, I assume it's like watching the early Archon films in Montreal must feel.
Mm-hmm.
Or Shivers a Rabbit, the films that Cronenberg shot there, because that's a Montreal where I've been there, I've walked, I remember actually making a point in one of my trips there to go to the locations just to see, and it's all gone. None of that is there anymore. And it's such a strange Hall of Mirrors experience. You know, New York films are the same way, or the Exorcist gave us the Georgetown Steps, which now just pay off in an apartment building, and it's really not that interesting. But it's really fascinating to revisit your own history, because people just weren't making movies in Toronto, and you have this slice of the city, other than Sam the Record Man, where I spent most of my teen years,
right.
But that stuff was just foreign and alien to me, and now it's a warming nostalgia in the Sam scene, and seeing the A&A sign next to it and on the street and all that, the stores that have long since vanished.
Yeah, and I was always curious, like the bottling plant, like where exactly was, because they're just like, they're at the bottling plant and then they're just cut to, they're in downtown Toronto.
Yeah, and it's like, massive. There, that would have been a huge
bottling
real estate.
Yeah, and it had to be like outside the city, so I'm sure, you know, not, couldn't have been in, I don't think that was in the core, so I'm like, these guys are kind of like,
I remember, I think the Pop Shop wasn't too far outside.
Really?
To the northwest, if I remember correctly. I grew up in Downsview, and I always thought it was around there somewhere.
Okay.
But again, I was a sheltered child, and I may have simply decided that it must be nearby.
And when I was watching the film again, I was thinking about a friend of my father's who moved to Toronto in the 70s, and he got a job. He actually got a decent job. This is, would have been after going down the road, but I think it was like in the mid-70s at some point. He moved to Toronto from PEI and then got a decent job working in some kind of a factory that paid better than it would have back home.
Right.
And he worked 4 days a week, Monday to Thursday, and then every Thursday he would get in his car and drive back to PEI.
Oh, God.
To spend the weekend in PEI, and then he'd drive back, straight back.
To go to work
on Monday.
Oh, my God.
And he'd do that every week.
How long did that last?
I don't know. I can't imagine it lasted that. I think it was like 6 months or 7 months. Like, he was here for like a year or something like that. But yeah.
And what was the drive like then? That's like a day and a half, isn't it?
Well, it's like a solid 17-hour drive. I mean, I'm sure he was gunning it the whole way, but,
yeah.
You know, he may have been able to get there in 15 hours. But that's how much he just couldn't resist going back. He just had to go back home.
Right. And that only works when the weather's good, too. I mean, you couldn't do that in the winter.
But you never know. He may have.
I suppose that's... you just have to be determined.
And, like, a friend of mine, Jeff, who's worked with me on different projects, his dad had a Toronto experience where him and, I think, a cousin moved to Toronto for a year or two and, like, lived in, like, a tiny little place together. And I'm sure their experience wasn't that different than going down the road.
Yeah. I was going to ask you this. How authentic do the maritime scenes feel? I mean, the prologue, the opening segment, is that recognizable to you as...
Well, I can't really say. Something that I read was that Shabib didn't shoot any of the film in the Maritimes at all. And I think he's using some stock footage of the Maritimes. I mean, he's really painting a very bleak portrait of the Maritimes in that prologue.
Mm-hmm.
In the opening. It could be recognizable East Coast. I mean, that was before I was born, so I'm sure in some parts of the Maritimes it would have looked like that. Like the homes that he was showing were basically like shacks. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, I've always just wondered if it's like a Toronto filmmaker's idea of the East Coast, because he must have gone, but...
Yeah, no, it feels very... It does feel very, like, very real Maritimes, but it definitely is like painting a bit of a bleak portrait of, like, the people and the place. I mean, he has to for that film.
Yeah, I'm sure you have to see where they're coming from.
You have to see where they're coming from, and I'm sure there's other images he could have used, but he's choosing to use these ones.
Yeah.
And with the Bruce Coburn song, though, it's, like, such a beautiful, sad opening.
Yeah, I've always wondered how that would have played outside Toronto. Like, just... You know, Toronto doesn't come off particularly well, but the Maritimes does not look good at all. In this vision.
But I mean, Maritimes were leaving. Like, I think in the 70s, it was a time where people were leaving in droves to find work and to find better jobs. I think the guys are portrayed as Cape Bretoners. I think they're from, they're supposed to be from Cape Breton. So I think, you know, if they had coal mines, and if they're supposed to be guys who worked in coal mines, it seems like it definitely would have been something that, you know, they would have done.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was very relatable to a ton of people there back in 1970.
Yeah. I also have no idea, realizing now, just how broadly screened this film was. I mean, it's not like it had, you know, it wasn't a blockbuster for Canada. It was a small drama, kitchen sink drama on the circuit. You would have played, I mean, things played longer at the time, but I can't imagine it had, you know, 100 screen release or anything.
No, I can't imagine. Yeah, I have no idea how widely seen it would have been. I mean, sure, the SCTV sketch would have brought way more attention to it than its original run, I'm guessing.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they even got Jane Eastwood in there, which is kind of amazing.
Which is amazing, yeah. She has, like, a go-to every time that something goes wrong. I don't know if it's like, oh, geez.
Yeah, I think so.
She's got something like that she keeps going back to. And, like, so much of the movie in the second half of it is kind of on her face. I didn't realize that either until I watched it again. Like, how much of it is just kind of, like, on her very sad face. You know that this isn't going to end up well for Jane Eastwood.
Yeah. Well, it's the heart of gold wisdom thing. I mean, it's a trope in its own way that women in these films are always smarter than the men. But, yeah, again, if you see it from her perspective, it's a genuine tragedy. You're watching someone get her heart broken and get stuck with a child and a husband she may never see again. And somehow, yeah, the movie goes out on a high note with that, because they're, for a second, we're in their heads. We're like, we can believe that there's a better possibility, because we've seen what they've gone through, and we've seen that there's a chance that they can start again. And yeah, it's such a weird experience to sit back and think about this movie that basically feels pretty good while you're watching it, and then just shivs you with this sense of abdicated responsibility.
And this, yeah, and it's like it feels to me like a fairly accurate depiction of how people end up on the streets, like how people are just kind of like one step away from losing it all, you know, through bad choices or just kind of circumstances out of their control.
Yeah.
You know, like once they lose their job in the bottling factory, like that's kind of the beginning of the end.
The clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking and they just can't recover. They just can't get their bearings after that. And it's just, I don't know who came up with the idea to rob that store, but
Yeah, I think we both know Pete did.
Yeah, we both know Pete did.
I think we did.
But Joey was very into eating the caviar. That was, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's the idea of, you know,
replacing the Kraft dinner.
Yeah, there's an easier way to get everything you want. You just have to be, willing to set everything about yourself aside and harm someone. It really, you know, like it's all there. It's all right in front of us. The appeal of the big city and the price you have to pay, and it's a simple morality tale, but it does such a great job of creating that layer of charm over it. And you know, you can watch this movie now after two or three viewings and go, oh, Pete's a monster. Like, he really is just using Joey. He gets lonely and wants a traveling buddy. That's clearly the only reason any of this stuff happens.
Yeah, and somehow he can't accept Joey just settling down and doing his own thing.
Right.
It's like when Joey finds like a woman that he loves, he says this to him, like, he doesn't just happen to get her pregnant and want to get married because he got her pregnant. He actually says that he loves her.
Yeah.
To Pete in a scene where they're in the bathroom of a bar. And yeah, you get the sense that somehow Pete just can't accept Joey settling for some reason. I don't know why it means so much to him to have his buddy just like accepting, like he'd be happy working at the bottling factory and having a child and being married. But for some reason, Pete can't accept that. It's like, why just go on your own? Like,
well,
why
can't be left behind, right? Like, he can't, if it's that classic sociopath's dilemma, right? Like, if someone else is successful, I must be miserable, so he can't succeed. So they have to be on the same keel, or Joey has to be more of a loser than Pete. And it's it's never spoken like that. I mean, you keep thinking about all the ways that a movie would ruin this now by having one big speech or one big revelation, or, you know, the Christian Bale moment where the mask cracks and we see just how awful Pete is and how much he's enjoying Joey's misery. I think the film is better for not having any of that, because obviously it's been floating around for 50 years and I'm only just figuring it out now. Mm-hmm. But there is so much matter of factness in that performance, where McGrath is just like, no, I got a better idea. Whatever it is, it's just like, no, let's do something else. Let's leave. Let's rob. Let's break the law. It doesn't really matter. We're not from here. Nothing's going to touch us. And he's right. Nothing will touch them. They'll just keep going. But yeah, the wreckage they leave in their wake, the stuff that is all there just because Pete didn't want to go to Toronto by himself. It's so awful and strangely compelling. Mm-hmm. Like, just watching them. You know, there's this old joke about somebody going to see Rocky a second or third time. It's like, yeah, I really like this movie and he might not lose this time. Every time I watch Going Down the Road, I want it to work out and I know it's not going to, but there's something so strange and pure about that relationship, about how much trust Joey puts in Pete and how horribly he's used by him every single time. It's just like, oh man, come on.
Mm-hmm.
You could have been happy.
And he has a real understanding of Pete too. Like, there's a couple times in the film where Joey calls out Pete. Like, you're never satisfied with anything. Like, this whole idea that Joey's never satisfied, or that Pete's never satisfied with anything that's going on. Like, yeah. And they talk about all the jobs that they've done together and how he's never happy with anything. But Joey, I think, is like, he just wants to drink beer and have a job and be it. But like, this constant dream, this big dream of Pete's, is this like the thing that's pulling them along, and nothing can get in the way of that. So this big idea of being, I mean, he says it out loud. He says that he just wants to, be remembered in some way. He wants to have like some kind of a legacy.
Yeah.
And he does. He ends up having this terrible legacy of like basically destroying this woman's life, essentially, and like depriving the child of a father and mm-hmm. and everything else. And then there's, when you're talking about the speech, I was thinking about the heartbreaking scene where they're getting, well, the wedding reception in the hall.
Yeah.
It's just like, it feels so real and so sad, and it kind of reminded me about the speech that Jack Nicholson gives him about Schmidt, or doesn't give. Like, this, because Pete is about to say, he kind of says a few words, but doesn't say what's on his mind, and kind of restrains himself and holds it in, but you know that there's just this cloud of anger.
Yeah.
Just below the surface. And then Joey gives the speech talking about how he knows that what everybody's thinking, because, you know, he knocked her up and now they're getting married, and there's just something so heartbreaking about the whole thing, and she's trying to get him to stop. And
yeah. Yeah. Again, she's smarter than both of them.
Yeah, she's smarter than both of them. And then there's the friend character too, who's there, who Pete could be with. Like, she's interested in him, but yeah, for some reason he just it's not good enough for some reason. It's not the dream of the lady who works in the bottling factory, who he did, the dream right. girl that he does get the date with,
the girl who's too, he's sure is too good for him, and she absolutely is.
Yeah,
yeah. But it is, you're right. He fixates on that. He wants what he wants, and it's never going to be enough for him. He'll never be satisfied, because as soon as he gets it, there's that weird. I could never figure out if it's because he's, you know, like, he's built up the idea of Toronto as being too good in the end, that he rejects it because it's going to, he rejects Toronto before Toronto can reject him, that Pete's dissatisfied all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because the minute she agrees to go out with him, he can't be interested in her anymore? Once she's attainable, she's no longer a worthy goal?
Yeah, I don't know.
The way he sees things is so strange and convoluted.
Yeah, because he gets very self-destructive. And another thing that was coming rattling around in my head when I was watching it the last time was The Hustler, somehow. Like, this idea, the whole George C. Scott speech about Paul Newman being a born loser, that he just can't help himself from making the wrong decisions and the wrong choices, that there's some element of self-destructive. He's got this self-destructiveness that he just can't help. And then it was kind of making me think about the Pete character, that he has this element of self-destructiveness that, he, no matter what comes his way, he would find some reason to not to be satisfied with it, or to kind of destroy it. And it's just kind of innate in his personality.
Yeah. Until you settle, your potential is limitless, right? Like, you can always do better. Although Pete's idea of doing better is really pretty penny ante to begin with. but he still can't be satisfied with it.
But it is different coming from the Maritimes. I think maybe more so now. Maybe it's not the same way now as it used to be, but like when you're born in a place where all your options don't feel like they're open to you, or that you can't do everything, like you do kind of have this feeling that you need to get somewhere else because you can't do what you want to do in the place that you grow up in,
right.
Or that you grew up in. Like you do feel somewhat limited, like, and you are to a certain extent in some of the things you're doing, probably not as much as they were in 1970. But yeah, you know, I can't even imagine what it would feel like to be born in Toronto and like feel like the world is your oyster in the way that like people do all kinds of things in Toronto.
Yeah,
you can be a filmmaker, you can work in advertising, or you can do this, you can do that. You know, back home, like growing up, it does feel to a certain extent that you can't do everything that you want to do.
But you don't feel that you don't deserve it. You just feel the opportunity isn't there?
Yeah, you just feel like the opportunity to do it at home is not there. So okay. you do kind of like, if you're kind of looking to do certain things, like you do feel like you kind of have to leave to do it.
Yeah, no, that's definitely nothing I've ever had to deal with here. I mean, part of it is you know, privilege and entitlement and luck. But yeah, Toronto, you're constantly surrounded with the examples of the things that you could do or could be. And yeah, I can't, I mean, I can imagine what it's like, but I can't at the same time really understand it, what the drive is. So maybe that's part of it too. It's like, yeah, you were in Sam the Record Man. You could have been perfectly happy. What's wrong with you guys?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's not where they came from.
No.
I would be perfectly happy to live my entire life in Sam the Record Man in 1970.
Well, yeah, it's funny. And then he even, that scene too, like he grabs that record. Like he just buys a classical music record because this gal that he saw,
because she smiled at him.
Because she smiled at him and she was listening to it. So he's just like, so he's open to this possibility of like other things, of like being sophisticated or other possibilities. And then his buddies are busy stealing country albums from the basement of the store. You know, so you have this contrast. And, but yeah, I think I do see like the attitudes of the East Coast a little bit in those two. They are there in those two characters. Like this idea that you should just be happy and stay where you are, and you know, don't expect too much, and work is work, and you know, just be happy that you have a job and you can put food on the table versus right. chasing a dream and
do it for sustenance, not for meaning.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Like that is still there. I mean, it's not there to the same extent now. Like I see people my age and younger who are pursuing different things in the Maritimes that they wouldn't have been doing 20, 30 years ago.
I mean, is that because it's possible to do it now, and just has the digital revolution collapsed the world and made it easier? I mean, I know you can make a movie anywhere for $10,000 now, basically, but that simply wasn't possible when you had to have film processed and developed, and it was expensive on every level. I just don't know if it... Are there other industries that are benefiting from that as well?
I think so. I think that there's like the entrepreneurial spirit, or like the kind of like the gig industry or mentality now is so pervasive that I feel like there's like people like doing graphic design or starting their own little businesses and feeling like they can do it back on the East Coast when they probably wouldn't have felt that way 15, 20 years ago. So I feel like that has changed. But of course then like in the... I think 10, 15 years ago, it was like the whole west, like migration west to Alberta.
Yeah.
It's like that was, you know, that kind of, so Alberta replaced Toronto as the place to go.
Hmm.
And
yeah, until the first winter.
And then that was the whole thing. But then the funny thing is that Alberta wasn't chewing out Maritimes and like chewing up and spitting them out the way that maybe Toronto, the big city, did. Because, you know, people were doing really well out there and coming home. And but again, it's a whole other issue. It's like people go out west now to Alberta, but they're like working for 2 weeks. They're gone from home like half the year, and it creates a whole other set of complications.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I mean, the world is so different now than it was in 1970, but I don't know that we are the center of the universe anymore. Everything's shifting. This is above my pay grade as I start realizing, no, I'm a Toronto guy talking about things I don't fully understand.
Well, I mean, it is kind of funny. Like, Maritimers do stick together. We're kind of very cliquish in that way. Like, a lot of my friends from back home stay together, and like there's like Nova Scotians and New Brunswickers that kind of just like stay in touch and kind of like that mentality. There's no Maritimer bar anymore, but that mentality definitely still exists. I wish there was a Maritime bar in Toronto.
Yeah, it's weird that there isn't. are there maritime or karaoke nights or something? Like, it's a roving thing that goes from place to place.
I don't know.
Culturally, there must be a way to capitalize.
Capitalize
that. It's all about capitalizing.
Let's call it going down the road. Let's call it going down the road.
Yeah, that's true.
The maritime bar in the big city.
There's got to be a better name.
Yeah, there probably is.
I mean, you could call it Pete and Joey's, but no one would want to go there. All the drinks would be watered down, and you'd never get any change from the cigarette machine. It would all be awful.
Yeah, it'd all be awful. And craft dinner gets a really... That's a very... I forgot about that line that was in the movie where she offers him. So Pete gets invited to Joey and his wife's place for supper, and they're cooking craft dinner.
Yeah,
I hope you like craft dinner.
It's a weirdly nostalgic moment for me. I grew up on that.
Yeah, I grew up in craft dinner too.
Yeah. And it's also it's sweet and sort of naive and
mm-hmm.
yeah. What was Canadian cuisine like in 1970? I don't even know. There were steakhouses. That's probably it.
Yeah, I guess. And, I guess, craft dinner would be a thing that you'd serve for supper. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had it as a kid for lunch a lot.
Yeah, if you weren't especially ambitious, maybe. Or if you were working and you just had to come home. Like, I remember TV dinners with foil on them, basically, mm-hmm. being a luxury for me when I was a kid, just because it was cool and weird, and it had, it came out of the oven, and it was all formed. But, yeah, it's not exactly bourgeois.
No.
To have craft dinner when your friend comes over, but it is something sweet and heartfelt. Like, it's a nice gesture.
It's a nice gesture. It's
something he'll be comfortable with.
And when you're working, in a bowling alley or a car wash,
Yeah, yeah. Or a bottling plant. It'd just be nice to come home to.
It'd be nice to come home to, a hearty bowl of craft dinner.
Our international audience has got no idea what we're talking about. It's macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni and cheese, mac and cheese.
Very specific mac and cheese. Yellow macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
Orange, even.
Very orange.
Ask Google. but yeah, so as far as going down the road as an influence or as a part of your aesthetic vision, is there anything of the film that you've borrowed or stolen or incorporated into your own creative DNA somehow?
Maybe in the way that, to do a lot of our projects, we've had to incorporate non-actors into them.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of element of spontaneity, trying to, maintain spontaneity and kind of, use the moment, I think maybe it's kind of leaked into it a little bit. Because I feel like in that film, he's kind of using people who were kind of, just doing their jobs. I'm sure the guy who's, playing the bottling plant manager is, the actual manager of the bottling plant, I'm guessing.
Yeah, probably.
Or a friend. So I think maybe that element of, just kind of trying to capture lightning in a bottle with non-actors and trying to keep spontaneity going and creating that feeling of something being alive when you don't have professionally trained actors necessarily all the time who can kind of give you that take after take after take.
Yeah.
And just kind of using what's around you. Using locations that just you have access to. They can just, hop in and hop out. And so using some of those elements of verite filmmaking or micro-budget filmmaking, but not necessarily done in that same style, but kind of using the people, places, and things that you just have at your disposal.
Sure.
Because he's definitely... It's like a guerrilla film through and through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're one of the only guests on this show that's encountered the filmmaker and actually gotten to talk to him about it, even though he wasn't especially proud of what he'd done, it sounds like. Did you actually talk about it in any detail? Did you get the chance with Shabit?
I think I may have asked some questions. I think he was kind of stunned by how much the students wanted to talk about going down the road. I think he was really surprised by how much admiration everyone had for the film. He definitely hadn't reconciled his feelings about the movie at that time. I think that was 2005 when he came into our class. I didn't get to ask him a question personally, I don't think, but I was happy. It did make me happy to see that he had gone back to it, even though I hadn't seen the sequel.
Yeah.
There was something about that kind of made me happy, that he was willing to go back there.
Yeah, prepared to look at it maybe creatively instead of as a weight.
Yeah, as a weight. Because I know it was his first feature. And I think what happens sometimes maybe with filmmakers is as you get older, you feel like you're gaining more skills and you understand the medium better. and you feel like you're always learning and getting better and improving, but that doesn't actually mean that your films are going to get better. It's like movies are weird that way.
Yeah.
From my point of view, it's just because you're getting better as a filmmaker doesn't mean the films are necessarily going to be better. Like somehow that movie has some magical, like you talked about the energy of it. It just has these weird magical ingredients to it that somehow make it work. And maybe looking back on, he just felt like it was not his best work as a director, but that doesn't mean that it's not.
Yeah. Somehow. Yeah, that's fair. Right. I mean, I've always, Soderbergh famously sort of wrote off his first four features when he made Schizopolis. He was saying, well, you know, I can't look at them anymore. And he's finally come back around to, you know, like there's a Criterion edition of King of the Hill and Sex Lies finally came out last year. And it took a long time for him to accept that there that other people found worth in them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those launched an entire movement of, you know, Canadian cinema. Like a national brand was born on the back of Shabib's film, and I'm sure he didn't intend for that to happen when he made it. So maybe that's it too. You just have to sort of disassociate yourself from the movement around the thing and just look at the thing again.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad he found a way back, even though I don't respect the end results of the process. Don't see the sequel. You just, you know, my half of my brain is like, send him home with the Blu-ray, let him watch it. No.
Well, I mean, I can't, yeah, like the gaping hole of not having Paul Bradley in it, I just can't see how you could really get past that.
Yeah.
Because so much of the movie is about their relationship and the energy between those two guys together. But I love Jane Eastwood, so I'd be curious.
Yeah.
So now I'm curious to see.
Yeah, Kathleen Robertson's really good, too, as the daughter that we've never met. That's...
Yeah. And they've got that car. Is this the same car?
The same car or another one.
With the same, yeah.
The same vehicle.
Same paint job.
Yeah. Pete still has the same car. You can put it that way.
So is the idea that they stayed together when they went out west? Like that they had like been together, like the Pete and Joey kind of stayed
no,
as friends?
No. He's surprised to find out that Joey has died.
So he's surprised
to find out. So that's where it opens, really.
Okay.
It would have just been so much more interesting if it had dealt with Joey's regret rather than Pete's lack of same. And he's sort of forced to confront the things he's done, but he did them. He didn't do them directly, so he's sort of the devil on Joey's shoulder and going down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so a movie where somebody realizes that he's done all these things rather than a movie where he realizes that his friend didn't have a great time because of his suggestions, just it doesn't have the same impact.
Right.
It's not McGrath's fault, but it's kind of inert. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, you just start... It's also long enough that you just start thinking, why am I here? Like, why did we bother? If this is the story you wanted to tell.
Did his career take off after going down the road, McGrath?
He worked constantly. He never really went away.
Yeah.
I don't think he had another performance that was quite as iconic. Unless I'm just the fact that I constantly confuse him with Derek McGrath means that there wasn't one.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It's funny. Maybe he played the role so well that people just thought it was real. Again, that verite sensibility where someone gives an amazing performance and you don't see it as a demonstration of range.
Right.
Because he's just so good that he disappears.
Yeah, whereas Paul Bradley, you can never have the movie on his shoulders, I don't think, because he just couldn't pull the weight. I mean, so like...
Yeah, he has to be more passive.
He has to be more passive and...
The more passive role.
The more passive role. And he... The way Shabib kind of has him in there, he's kind of using... I see him... Just from my own point of view, I can see him kind of like situating him in a place where he can really shine, where he doesn't have to carry too much of the load.
Mm-hmm.
He's there in the right moments, in the right time. And because I don't think he necessarily has the same chops as so, but he can like do his thing and like give an amazing performance in that other way that he doesn't have to carry like the emotional burden of the Pete character.
Yeah, no, we get to feel for him mm-hmm. in the moment. So he just all he really needs to do is be there and take it.
Yeah.
While we sympathize.
But I still love like the scene where the two guys are talking. They're in the bottling plant and Pete's trying to explain to Joey like how what they're doing at the plant is meaningless.
Yeah.
That they're stacking, like doing all these, like stacking all these crates of bottles, and it's just going away at the door, and nothing they're doing matters. And Paul Bradley's just so wonderful in that scene. Like, he's like, he just doesn't understand what he's talking about.
But I'm doing my job. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can see he's, the work is the thing that he's doing, and he's focused on it. Yeah, yeah, it's true. Whereas Pete wants to be remembered and leave his mark, even though it's going to be a disastrous mark and leave scars and be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's the endless contradiction of that movie. It's still so much fun watching people make the wrong decisions.
Yeah, and another movie I was thinking about too is Midnight Cowboy for some reason. Like,
yeah, I mean, it lines up. They're right around the same time, and again, it's two people in a self-destructive relationship. And somebody else mentioned Easy Rider a couple of times.
Yeah.
Although I think that's really just more because of the independent nature of it. I don't really see a lot of resonance between those two, but Midnight Cowboy makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because I remember I watched Midnight Cowboy shortly after Going Down the Road. I think I had seen Midnight Cowboy before I saw Going Down the Road, but then I went back to Midnight Cowboy. I couldn't believe how slick and shiny Midnight Cowboy seemed after watching Going Down the Road.
Sure.
You know, even though, like, it was a fairly gritty flick, Hollywood flick in 1969 or 67 or whenever it came out. But then, but the relationship between, like, Ratso and John Boyd's character kind of, there's definitely some, but
Some resonance
there, but I think, you know, like, it's just like, it's very, the grittiness of Going Down the Road, it's still very gritty.
Yeah. Even in restorations, it doesn't look shiny. It never did.
Yeah.
But that does work, right? Like, it steeps it in authenticity and makes it feel just, you can see grime, you can see the kitchen counters aren't totally clean. It doesn't feel staged in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like you've wandered into these people's lives and you're with them for a while, and then they leave and we're left behind. And it's like, it's, I still want it to work out. I still want them to find happiness, and they never will. That's the contradiction of the film. It just keeps coming back.
Yeah, not even Young Street can bring them back.
Young Street can't save happiness. Them.
No.
Harvey's is closed now.
What are you going to do? But then I'm remembering, like, one of the things that Don Chabit did talk about with Going Down the Road was the transitions.
Mm.
And the movie is full of these great transitions. Like, of, like, the shot, kind of, like, almost, like, shot cuts, like, where it goes from a very quiet scene to, like, the whistle at the plant and, the bottles kind of coming through. And it's full of these very dramatic transitions where it's going from quiet to loud. And he talked about how, like, that was, like, a trick from his old documentary days of doing docs, was to, like, incorporate these transitions of going from very quiet to very loud, and just, like, great insert shots of the plant, of, like, the bottles coming down, and but then also, again, like, with the style of it, also, but then also, like, kind of, like, very nice, like, there's some very fluid, like, movements, camera movements that don't feel like a documentary at all. Like, so there's, like, these kind of, like, narrative filmmaking techniques that are kind of thrown in there with the verite style, but you just don't really see it, like, unless you're really looking for it. Like, there's, like, some beautiful, like, tracking shots in there, and some walk and talks, and
well, this is what I mean about the rules not being formed, right? Like, it's because it's functioning as both dramatic feature and documentary, some part of your brain is responding to those differences and trying to reconcile them into a single work, which I think is why it feels so weird and unpredictable, even though I've seen the movie a number of times. I shouldn't be set on edge or surprised by it, but it's always some part of my brain is always being tugged at by the movie, because it won't obey the rules. It's just doing what it wants to do, which again makes it feel like it's really happening right in front of you.
Well, yeah, like the scene in Ellen Gardens is a scene that's just that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the, like, a famous one where they, I can't remember, it was one of the actors or somebody was very close by or was in that park, and these people had gathered around.
Yeah, I heard that story. He called Shabib and had him come down.
And had him come down with the camera. And, like, it's just unfolding in front of you. And there's something, I mean, that's a sad scene for a lot of different reasons. But very real. Like, everything that's happening is just, like, happening in front of your eyes. But now I'm very, very curious to know, like, did a lot of the people in the film even know they were in the movie? Like, these shots of the old fellows in the Salvation Army, like, was Shabib just, like, in there with the camera just picking off whatever he could?
I mean, I bet so.
You know?
Like, why wouldn't you do that in 1970, right? Like, that's just, you didn't need releases, you didn't need notices. I'm sure there was really no legal prohibition, right? It was a small movie. They didn't have anybody. There was nothing they could be sued for.
No.
Like, it's just, can we, it might have even been simply, you know, stay here. You want to be in a movie. We'll make a movie. Nobody would have thought twice about it in 1970. Nobody ever figured this thing would happen or get released.
Yeah.
Who makes movies in English Canada? Like, this was...
Yeah, see, I don't know that much of the history of it before. Like, I've heard of that it was, like, the birth of English language cinema in Canada, but I didn't really know what was going on before that.
There was a big documentary movement through the NFB, but as far as I know, English language dramatic features just didn't happen. I'm trying to remember where Winter Kept Us Warm fits into this. It's either 1964 or 1974. Mm-hmm. But that's the only other one I can think of being shot in Toronto that wasn't some sort of location shoot for a foreign production. And even then, we weren't doing that. That didn't happen. Like, Tax Shelter Days, maybe. But this predates most of those. It wasn't until going down the road that people realized you could make movies here.
So that's kind of astonishing to me. So there was basically no, even with what was going on in the U.S., no, with Hollywood.
There was television.
There was television.
CBC was doing live-to-videotape stuff. But feature films just weren't happening.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And then was the Tax Shelter, the whole Tax Shelter era, did that come, was that kind of on the heels of going down the road?
72, yeah. I mean, stuff like, when was Cannibal Girls made? That's the one, that's the one I always think about as the sort of the thing that really started. Like, Black Christmas was 74, Cannibal Girls predated that, I think, and the internet says, 1973. So, 73. Yeah, it would have been like a year or two later, the ball got rolling with a lot of this stuff, and very little of it was any good. Nobody was trying to make Going Down the Road. That was the thing, right? They just realized that you could make movies here. They didn't have to be good or memorable. And some of them are just out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that there was going to be a sudden revolution of Canadian films that were about something and spoke to the moment, that didn't really happen. You know, we had a couple of films here and there that started, but it wasn't even in the 70s. It was Heartaches. That's the film.
Heartaches.
Don Shabib made Heartaches in 1981 with Margot Kidder, and that was 10 years later. And it's a different kind of story about somebody taking a pregnant young woman under her wing. But the industry just didn't exist to make, you know, quote-unquote proper movies. I mean, if you look back at Canadian cinema in the 70s, it's all Québécois. And then here we have stuff like The Silent Partner and The Kidnapping of the President and movies that were genre products that were supposed to legitimize the industry. Mm-hmm. And they kind of do. Like, they were technically well made, but they weren't remembered for anything. Like, what's The Grey Fox? 81, 82? That was the start of the real legitimate cinematic movement.
Yeah.
Because even Cronenberg's films, while great, are still genre pieces. And the first two were made in Montreal.
Really?
Yeah, Shivers and Rabbit.
And what year were those?
74 and 75? Or 74 and 76.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what happens now. Like, the way the Telefilm has restructured their funding, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start to see the micro-budget films this fall, right? Like, they'll start to roll out.
Yeah.
Which was shot last year is going to be ready. And there's going to be so much of it. I look forward to it because we are starting to see, I think the last 4 or 5 years already has been a really good period for Canadian cinema. We're starting to see it figure out what it can do well and what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's going to be interesting. And I would love to see someone come up with something like Going Down the Road now, because that's the movie I keep thinking about where you can't duplicate the energy, but the structure is perfect. You could tell that story in a million different ways from any other community to any other city in Canada. And maybe someone can do that in a way that kind of sparks the interest again.
But yeah, there's like, I'm very curious. I think it's going to be a great thing because more people are getting a foot in the door in Canada in terms of being able to make a film, even if it's with $150,000 or $100,000. You know, because once they get that foot in the door, then they can make another film and they can, you know, and maybe out of 20, two of them might turn out to be really, really great. But
yeah,
that's a lot more than we had probably 15 years ago when it was extremely difficult for anyone to get funding.
Sure. And the other 18 can do other stuff too. They can keep working, get better, and refine themselves, do television, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're at a place right now where I feel really, really hopeful. And it's not something I'm used to feeling. It's good. It's good to look forward.
Yeah, it is great to look for. I mean, because Shabib was only 28 when he made Going Down the Road. So, like, you know, yeah. So he was a young guy. He'd done a ton of documentary stuff, but so he's a very young filmmaker when he made that. I didn't realize that until I read that last week, I think, that he was only 28.
Yeah, it makes sense, too. I mean, you have to be young enough to be that ambitious to think you can pull off something that's never been tried before.
Yeah, in a young man's story.
Yeah, it's true. He's smarter about it than they are, which is really important, right? If a younger filmmaker might have bought into the delusions, and an older filmmaker might make it too obvious that they're not going to make it. This mm-hmm. one, he's exactly in the right place to just observe and report.
Observe and report, yeah.
Yeah, and make us realize what's going on in third and fourth viewings and just still want to keep watching.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, that poor guy.
Which poor guy?
Oh, Joey.
Joey, yeah.
Screw Pete. He brought it on himself.
My thanks to Jeremy Larder, whose new film Poggy Beach is available for rental and purchase on iTunes right now. You can also find the series, Just Passing Through, on YouTube. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. You can find Jeremy on Twitter at Jeremy Larder, all one word, and you can find Going Down the Road on Blu-ray in a special edition from Elevation Pictures. The bad news is it's a twofer that also includes Down the Road Again, but you don't have to watch that. You really, really don't. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.